All right, by applause, should I keep it, nerdalogs.com. Yeah. All right, well, I will take that under consideration. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve. It is a real treat to see you twice in one weekend. That, man, fucking killing it. Guys, we have some very special guests in the house. Kevin Reeder already mentioned them. Their information is on this card right here that I dropped 5 minutes ago. The House Theater is here tonight. They are here in anticipation of their soon opening The Hammer Trinity. We're going to tell you all about that throughout the night. But right now, we're going to bring up The Hammer Trinity's playwright. This is Chris Matthews.
Hi. My name is Chris Matthews. I'm a company member with the House Theater of Chicago. If you don't know anything about the House, we've been around for about a little over 10 years now. We do all original works that tend to be very epic and imaginative in ambition and scope. Our mission is to unite Chicago in the spirit of community through amazing feats of storytelling. And while that could take on a lot of faces, it tends to mostly represent itself through the fact that most of us sort of grew up on Robert Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg and early Star Wars and are sort of Joseph Campbell fiends. And so a lot of our work tends to be very mythic and epic and imaginative in scope. We've done adaptations of some of the popular myths like The Wizard of Oz, Peter Pan. We did an adaptation of Ray Bradbury's stories that are found in the Martian Chronicles called Rocket Man. We've done our own sort of anachronistic, updated play, musical version of The Nutcracker that sort of takes the, sort of returns to the basics of the story and puts it on a modern day family dealing with grief. That's sort of on the adaptation end, and all of those things involve a lot of wonderful fantasy or sci-fi or fantastic elements. And then on the original end, we've done like a bio play on Harry Houdini and sort of mythologized it by pitting his insane acts of escapism and conquering the impossible with a sort of fabled contest with death, and it was called Death and Harry Houdini, and we performed the water torture cell escape live on stage. We did a crazy musical trilogy, a superhero trilogy that part one was a Western, part two was a Japanese martial arts punk rock show, and then part three was set in 1930s Chicago, and it was big band and jazzy and smoky and very noir. We've done a story chronicling the Hatfield and McCoy feud and the sort of epic rivalry that they shared. We're sort of all over the map, and we sort of tend to explore a lot of different genres. And I think we're pretty fun. That said, with all the fun, it's all sort of like in a spirit to reconnect with the audience that we're trying to serve. And as far as like house rules are concerned, probably my favorite rule is a non-rule that we have, which is not trying to create any artificial barriers between ourselves on stage or in the house with our audience. We hope and strive to make sure that theater is a very communal event in which we're all sharing and taking part in storytelling. So we strive to really find a connection between what we're doing on stage and the reaction and participation in the audience. That doesn't necessarily mean throwing popcorn at the villains. I suppose it could. We'd probably have to serve popcorn. Maybe we should. We should serve popcorn. Okay, yeah, serve popcorn. We hope that, like I said, to sort of return theater to a more communal experience, to make it fun. And so a few years ago, Nate, our artistic director, Nathan Allen, and I, we've partnered on a couple of projects. We wrote a story with Jake Minton called Dave Da Vinci Saves the Universe about a time-traveling scientist trying to save his daughter from a horrible fate. A show called The Sparrow, which was about a young girl with telekinetic powers who found herself serving as the small-town cheerleader superhero. And we wrote a show about a young girl called Rose in the Rhyme, in which a young girl has to sort of save her town from its sadness and sorrow and poverty by going and claiming a magic coin to return to the town and bring prosperity back and defeat the witch. And also she'll then turn into the witch because it sort of corrupts her, the power. Anyway, I just kind of ruined the whole thing. If all of this is just sort of paint a picture in a backdrop of sort of where we live. A few years ago, Nate had been sort of flirting with an attraction to the King Arthur legend and wanting to maybe see about what was possible in our interests there. And we as a company, turned 10, having survived a decade, which included a really sort of quick burst onto the scene where we were sort of instantly praised and lauded, and we experienced some immediate popularity that was overwhelming to all of us, and it felt like we were doing it, man. It felt like we were like out to slay, you know, the dragon of boring theater that we were so upset against in college, and as our teachers were trying to pound American realism into us, we were like, no, there could be another way. and our way is better, and we're going to go out and do it, man. And it felt like we were doing it. And then we all turned 28, and we all suddenly had other priorities than this little like theater company that we'd been creating. We all started like, you know, having families or thinking about like, well, you know what? I'm not really getting paid much money, so I'm going to go do this other thing. Or, I actually don't want to do theater anymore. I want to be a physical therapist. So there was like a weird disintegration of this community that we'd been building. And then that timed in with the recession, and it was just all horrible, and it just felt like it all was falling apart because we all hated each other and we were upset, and like no one was happy because we'd gotten everything that we wanted, but it was nothing that we wanted. And then things calmed down like they do a little bit, and there was a sort of like natural return of the people who wanted to return, and a sort of a peace with the people who didn't. And it felt like we had sort of survived this strange, it's not strange, this very natural decade that, you know, is your 20s, or, you know, is the VH1 Behind the Music story of every band, you know? So suddenly the Arthur myth felt very sort of attractive on a biographical level, like this sort of charts our experience on a mythic level. You know, you've got Arthur and Merlin building this ideal of a round table in which everyone has a say, and we're gonna create our own Camelot, and we're going to change the world for the better and set it right the way it should be. And then it all falls apart due to inner tensions and struggles and facing outer foes that maybe you should or shouldn't be facing. And it all disintegrates, and then it comes back together, ? Is something that is, you know, everyone's better for having had the experience, ? Or if some characters are dead. What did we learn? And anyway, it just sort of charted a beautiful sort of, it's a beautiful cycle of myth. And we started examining that, and then it sort of, it didn't seem, it didn't seem accessible or right, or it felt short of our ambitions to just adapt Arthur, you know? It's so specifically tied to nationalist England. Like it's theirs. It's their myth. It's their origin story, you know? And we started asking ourselves, like, well, what if we put it in America? So, like in true, you know, Hero with a Thousand Faces style, we started changing the faces of the players and changing the setting, and interesting, interesting things started happening when we took this story of a would-be king and trying to, like, get this person their crown in a sort of setting that, as we understand it as Americans, is completely, antithetical to how our nation was born. And while what we've come to make isn't quite it's sort of not quite America. All of our dressings are sort of American in their look, so it hopefully it asks some good questions. So I'm taking over time. What we've come to is like creating this like trilogy of plays called The Iron Stag King, The Crownless King, and then part three, the Excelsior King, which we've done in succession in the past couple of years. We started with part one, and then the next year we produced part two, The Crownless King. And in presenting part three, The Excelsior King, we're doing all three in a row, in full days of full marathon events. And we hope that people will come. Because it's 9 hours, and it's fantasy, and it's magicians and warriors and girls with bows and arrows, and we've never really quite delved into the like specifically the high fantasy genre, but we think it's fun, and we're in the middle of rehearsals now, and it's going well, and I hope well we're doing it at least, we're going to be reading some of it a little bit later tonight, so hopefully it'll give you a peek into what we're up to. It's definitely been a fun experience to sort of chart this group of unlikely friends through the rise and fall of their own internal community, and to see what is the point of any of it. TheHouseTheater.com. Thank you.
Chris, let me read the official plot synopsis of the Hammer Trinity here. Follow the story of young Casper Kent recovering the lost hammer and taking the crown, defending it against pirates and the Crownless faction, and choosing if he will relinquish the hammer's tremendous power for the greater good. Sounds pretty fucking cool. All right, guys, we are going to hear more from the Hammer Trinity.